Once a month, we visit with a researcher from the University of Oregon about some of the discoveries being made or at least sought at the UFO. We call the monthly visit Curious, Research Meets Radio. This month, we welcome back Lauren Panicio, Assistant Professor of Biology, attached to the Institute of Ecology and Evolution and head of the Panicio Lab. Dr. Panicio knows bees and studies them in many places and many roles. Lauren Panicio, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
It is a pleasure. It's been half a year since we talked to you. That was back in April, but it's been quite a half a year, hot and dry and fiery. What can you tell us about bee health generally at the moment?
That's a tricky one, I guess. One thought is that bees do like it hot and dry, but flowers need water to make pollen and nectar. So it probably hasn't been the best year for bee populations.
We've been hearing about other pollinators, particularly about monarch butterflies and their crashing numbers. Is there anything quite that extent in the world of bees?
Yes, there actually are a couple species of bumblebees. So like the big fuzzy adorable ones that we know their populations have plummeted similarly to the monarch. So actually in Oregon, we have two species of bumblebees that might be federally listed with the Endangered Species Act soon.
Franklin's bumblebee, one of them? Or is that
two others, actually.
Two others, yeah, in addition to that.
Yeah, so Bombus occidentalis, which is the western bumblebee. It used to be the most common bumblebee in the West, hence its name. And that one, I mean, you basically never see it anymore since I think around the 1990s, its populations really just took a turn. And then Bombus sucklii, which has a terrible name.
Right, it does.
It's a really cute bumblebee. Apparently, it was named after a person. So
I kind of figured, okay. when we got the word that Franklin's bumblebee earlier was listed as endangered, that was quickly followed by declarations of extinction for a bunch of other creatures. I mean, it seems like for quite a few things out there, things have gotten quite dire.
Yeah, it's been a long time in coming, and I think that actually the listings are more people finally paying attention to the insects versus their populations just starting to decline. Their populations have been declining for a while.
I want to come back to the basic attraction for you and bees, because I think back in my teens, very few people would have referred to bees as cute fuzzy ones, like you did for bumblebees. But we've kind of modified our thinking, haven't we? When we realize that bees can do good things for us, we're not as afraid of getting stung and nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've always felt that bees as an insect really get people on board, because not only are they quite fuzzy and adorable, they're also, all they do is visit flowers, right? They just eat pollen and nectar. They're not carnivorous. They're not going to bother you at your picnic. They just like to hang out, visit flowers, be fluffy, and then, you know, provide all this food for us. So everyone loves bees. That's what I always say. I'm like, you know, everyone just loves bees, Republicans, Democrats, you know, people in cities, people not in cities. It's something that anyone can get on board with.
It crosses all those divides. Yay for bees. But we've talked in the past about the difference between, you know, the bumblebees and the honeybees, the honeybees not being native. I mean, have the honeybees in any way contributed to the dropping numbers of the domestic bumblebees?
This is a very contentious issue, because you can imagine that you know, honeybees are very important bees for our agricultural system, also for production of honey. And so we want to support them, and we want to have really healthy honeybee populations. On the other hand, you know, imagine one of our other domesticated animals, like chickens, like just kind of wandered off, and you're in the middle of, you know, a beautiful forest and somewhere in Oregon, and you see all these chickens walking around. You'd be like, oh, what are those chickens doing here? You know, that's not right. Like, I still love chickens, but you don't belong here. And that's kind of what's happening with honeybees, where even though they're incredibly important in our agricultural system, they've made it across every continent besides Antarctica. There's probably more honeybees today than there ever have been in the past. And, you know, they visit flowers and drink nectary pollen too. So there's only so much pollen and nectar out there.
So do bees need a little extra help from people to survive? I mean, we've talked a fair amount, mostly in our gardening segment, about pollinator gardens, but let's just talk in general terms about the kinds of things that humans can do to give bees a leg up.
Yeah, gardening is a really important thing that people can do, because urban areas, or, you know, just people's gardens generally can host a ton of bees, especially if you're planting native plants. So a lot of cultivars, though, even though they're beautiful, so these are like plants like dahlias or something like that, they don't produce any pollen or nectar. And so even though they make these big showy flowers, we've bred them not to produce pollen and nectar because we don't want them to cause people allergies or things like that. But whereas if we have native plants, those produce a lot of resources that will actually attract bees. And it's almost amazing how quickly, like once you start planting native plants, all these new bees will start showing up in your yard and those populations will just build and build. And so that can be really important.
Does it help though if you're in an island? I mean, if you're trying to create a pollinator friendly area, but there's nobody within a quarter mile of you doing the same thing, will the bees find their way to you necessarily?
That is a big question. If you are completely isolated, in the middle of the desert with nothing around you, it might be tricky for them to find their way. But once they do, then they might form a population right at your garden. That's the thing about bees is they don't need as much habitat as something like a mammal, that needs a home range and lots of space. Bees can live in pretty small patches.
Mm-hmm. I mean, interesting what you were saying, though, about some of the ornamental plants. I mean, I knew that there'd been a lot of hybridization and breeding to get certain traits out, but I didn't realize that it included not only removing odors, but removing pollen, removing nectar.
Yeah. If you take a look at a lot of roses and just kind of poke your finger in there and see if you can get it covered in like yellow pollen, you'll find nothing. They just don't produce pollen anymore.
Wow, that's amazing. We're talking to Lauren Panicio in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio, joining us again after a visit in April, talking about her work with bees. You can join us as we talk about what goes on at the Panicio Lab and far out into the field at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So did you do a lot of field work over the course of the summer?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, we had two different field seasons going on, one in New Mexico and Arizona, up on the tops of these mountains where we have these gorgeous high elevation meadows, and then also in the Sierras. That was a bit of fun. And then we also have been working on figuring out ways to restore clear cuts particularly after all the fires as well. A lot of people lost their tree plantations due to the fires in 2020. Mm-hmm. And so now they're replanting, but there's all this amazing habitat out there that could have bees in it.
Well, we talked about that a bit when you were here in April. So talk about the kinds of things that people need to keep in mind when they're replanting after fire or replanting after clear cut, things that would be beneficial to bees.
And this is the same with people's gardens, is planting native seeds. So not a lot of times if you go to the nursery or something, you'll have a quote unquote native seed mix, but it'll include a lot of things that are not for Oregon. Like, even though I love California poppies, there are California poppies. And so there are a lot of amazing seed mixes out there that if you look for nurseries that specialize in kind of restoration, Heritage Seed Company is one of them, and a lot of others are more regional. They're based in the Willamette Valley, and their whole thing is just, what's right for your area, what can you plant? And then once you have that, just make sure to plant things with lots of flowers.
Because that's where they go. The flowers are the announcing mechanism, aren't they? It's like, hello, bees, here we are.
That is exactly what they're made for, too.
So how specific can it be, though, from place to place? I mean, I think about things like in Josephine County, the Darlingtonia Fens in the Illinois Valley that are unique to that area. I mean, when you're looking for local vegetation or native vegetation, it can be very specific in some places, can't it?
It can be super specific. And a lot of times what we don't want to do is, beyond just putting things that don't belong in a place, you might put something that's from northern Oregon and somewhere in southern Oregon, and then it's just not adapted to that environment, even if it's the right species. And you'll either waste a ton of seed and money, or you'll get weird interbreeding with native populations. Cause a lot of problems.
Let's talk about some of the summer field work. New Mexico and Arizona, the mountain meadows you were talking about, how are they doing? What kind of shape are they in? I don't know what the drought situation is in those areas.
Actually, it was completely the opposite of here. It felt so strange to get in a truck, drive to New Mexico, and get rained on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember getting, there was some actual, some fairly heavy monsoon rains over the course of the summer.
Exactly. Yeah, there were these amazing thunderstorms. There were quite a few adventures the film crew had. A tree fell across the road at one time and kind of trapped them in. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. But yeah, it really, really rained for the first time in, I think, 4 or 5 years. And we caught so many bees. So they just, are able in some way to detect, okay, this is going to be a really good year. And a lot of bees will nest in the ground and somehow be able to be triggered by these cues of moisture and just like emerge right out, and then tons of bees.
How long do bees live? I guess that's a good starting question here.
Well, it's incredibly variable. So in general, most bees are solitary, which means they don't have the whole colonial thing. So the European honeybees, bee we know, that does the very complex, queens and workers and the whole thing. But most bees just are regular insects, living their little lives. Each female mates, makes a nest. And so they'll often make these nests underground. And then the little larvas will eat the pollen and nectar that the female bee has provided for them and turn into a pupa, just like monarchs do. It looks like a chrysalis. It looks like a little, ensconced bee.
In some kind of little casing?
Yeah, a little casing. And they can stay like that for a very long time. I'm sure it's species dependent. It's something that's very difficult to figure out because, as you can imagine, there's a lot of bees out there, and that would involve digging a lot of random holes. Looking like, is it still good? Okay. But we know that, for example, in the Atacama Desert, it'll rain, once in a blue moon, and then all these bees will emerge from the ground. So they've been there for years and years.
Wow. Were they just there? Oh, just okay, so it's in some sort of, pre-hatched kind of situation then.
Exactly. Most of them are in that, pupa stage where they're, waiting to become the full adult bee.
Wow. We've had this discussion about aquatic creatures like at Lake Ebert, the brine shrimp there, that if the water is that low and therefore too briny, they'll just stay in egg form until the water gets greater in volume and lower in salinity. And so it's a similar situation that it sounds like with the bees. When the conditions are good, they'll come out.
Yeah, we think that they're able to sense something about moisture and maybe temperature as well.
Wow.
Even in that state.
So was there a much greater presence of bees this year in that area that you were studying than in previous years?
Yes. So I actually started this project as a graduate student, and that was in 2011 or 12 when it rained a lot. And we just caught all of these bees, and it was an incredible place to work. And then we kept on sampling. And the subsequent years, we just really did not see very much. There weren't that many flowers. There weren't that many bees. We actually saw a ton of European honeybees. So they often kind of move in when the native bees are declining. And then this year it was like hitting the reset button. So lots and lots of amazing bees, lots of flowers, species we hadn't seen for 10 years. Yep, 10 years.
Wow, yeah, 10 years. You mentioned a film crew with you. What were you shooting for?
We were taking lots of photos and things like that and just recording what people were up to. Not a full movie or anything like
okay.
that.
Okay. That's what I was asking about.
I'd love to watch that movie full of bees.
Yeah, I bet you would. I want to ask Lauren Panizio about one of your other things going on, because I understand that you've been doing some work with almond growers in California to try to figure out ways where the honeybee colonies that are brought in to do the pollination, basically trucked in to do that work, how they can be less endangered by the work.
Well, that wasn't actually quite what the study was about. The goal was actually to understand how growers can do bee-friendly practices in their orchards.
Mm-hmm.
So what they can do to support bees in their orchards, this might be something like planting cover crops down the aisles of the trees, installing permanent pollinator habitats, things like hedgerows along the edges, or also applying for bee-friendly certification. So there's quite a few out there. There's one through the Xerxes Society called Bee Better, pretty adorable name.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, do all these bee-friendly practices, and then we can slap a label on your almonds, like you might see for sustainable fisheries or something like that, that say, this is a Bee Better product. And we wanted to know how many growers were actually doing it already, how many almond growers, And then what might incentivize them to implement these practices in the future?
All right. So, have you gotten a great adoption from almond growers? I mean, have they picked up a lot of these practices, or were a bunch of them doing them already?
Not really. The most common practice that was being done and that people were interested in were cover crops. So cover crops are a little less permanent. You know, you can sort of scatter seeds, often use winter rains to let them germinate. And we did see that about 51% of growers were either doing them already or interested in them. So that was a big one. But in terms of the more difficult things like permanent pollinator habitat, we saw much less interest and much less adoption. So it was a bit disappointing.
Without those kinds of bee-friendly environments, can the job of pollination be fairly stressful on the traveling colonies?
It can be. A lot of bees, like, having different plants beside almonds can provide nutritional diversity. So it's like instead of just eating one thing over and over again, the bees can have a little bit more different types of foods. And so that can really promote their health, increase their resistance to parasites and diseases. Another thing is, unlike the honeybees that get trucked in, if we want wild bees, native bees in those almond orchards, they have to live there full time. They can't just be, moved around. So that pollinator habitat can be really important, particularly for the wild bees.
Interesting. So I mean, how do the people who are traveling around with the honeybee colonies feel about having wild bees in there? Is there any particular threat to the honeybees that they bring in from the wild bees?
There isn't a threat so much in terms of they're never at high enough abundances where they would really be pushing the honeybees out. In fact, people have found that if there are wild bees and honeybees in the same almond orchard, this actually increases the pollination efficiency of the honeybees. So honeybees are kind of lazy in that they like to go like flower to flower mm-hmm. to flower, just move as little as possible. But with almond, you actually need to move between trees. So trees are completely, it's called self-incompatible, so they cannot pollinate themselves. And so you need to move one flower on one tree to, another row to another flower to get a successful pollination event, to get an actual almond. So if there are native bees around, for some reason, the honeybees and the native bees, they don't like hanging out really close to each other. So the honeybees will move around a lot more, same with the native bees. And so it'll really increase their efficiency of pollination and the number of almonds they create in those pollination events. So only pluses. I mean, I think there is a concern that, if suddenly the almond industry stopped needing honeybees, but that's basically impossible. There's just way too much almond in cultivation. I think it's about 1.5 million acres in California alone in cultivation. And that's larger than the size of many small countries. And we just cannot, wild bees cannot pollinate that. It all blooms, within a couple weeks. And just to have the abundance of wild bees couldn't be done. We will need honeybees in that system no matter what.
Okay. All right. So a lot we learn about bees every time we talk to you. And we'll talk to you again down the road because the fascination is contagious. Lauren Panicio from the University of Oregon. Thanks once again.
Thank you.